Very well. We will go on to the third case of the morning, number 052620, Daniels against Knight. Halt.
Good morning, Your Honors. Karen Baumhold on behalf of the appellant, Michael Daniels. This case has been through a long history, but I think the focused question for the court this morning is whether or not what the Indiana Supreme Court referred to as deplorable conduct of counsel prejudiced Mr. Daniels' defense. Just very briefly, I'd like to outline for the court, it's in our briefs, but all of the evidence that was at counsel's disposal that they simply did not use.
Can you address at some point the question of procedural default?
And yes, I will do that, Your Honor. I can do that first if it would.
I think the panel would probably appreciate having that addressed first. It is the threshold
Indeed.
Problem.
Certainly. First and foremost, I would direct the panel's attention to Section C of the Indiana Supreme Court's decision in Daniels 3. The title of that section is Res Judicata and Waiver, and this court has repeatedly said that Res Judicata is not a procedural bar to federal review. The state ignores that entirely.
But that is the state Supreme Court saying that it's Res Judicata in the state court because the matter could have been raised in the first post-conviction matter, isn't it? The first post-conviction hearing, am I correct?
I'm not sure I understand the question. I believe that res judicata, as opposed to waiver, does not operate to bar procedural default. And in this case, it's completely unclear whether the state court relied on its waiver principles, procedural principles, or principles of finality in res judicata. And two things flow from that. One is that res judicata simply doesn't operate to bar. The second is that in any case, the Indiana Supreme Court's decision is completely unclear, and the Supreme Court has told federal courts in Harris versus Reed and subsequent cases that if you cannot tell what the state court meant to do, then federal review is not barred. Federal courts are simply not to guess. And it's not just res judicata and waiver that's a problem here. The other problem is that the state court seems to address the merits of the claim in that section, but then talks about waiver and res judicata, and you can't tell. If you cannot tell what the decision rests upon, then federal review must be taken. And the district court rejected that argument below, went ahead to the merits, and I think that this court should do the same. The other reason why this case is not defaulted is that all of those rules regarding waiver in Indiana were unsettled well until after this case was decided. It was not clear whether a petitioner could raise ineffective assistance of counsel during first post-conviction proceedings or whether they had to raise it on appeal, and Ford versus Georgia tells you that if those rules are not well settled at the time that the petitioner is supposed to have defaulted, then the petitioner hasn't defaulted. Now, given all that, we have a case where trial counsel, as I noted for the court, the Indiana Supreme Court called that performance deplorable in many respects, and I don't think that the state really disputes that counsel's failures were absolutely ineffective, constitutionally ineffective, with one exception, of course, and that'd be the hypnosis of Tim Street. But this isn't one of those cases, Your Honors, where every single witness was clear and one tiny error by counsel left loads of evidence untainted. Instead, you have every single witness here affected by the errors of counsel. Take, for example, Stephen McCloskey, who testified that he was certain, eyewitness testimony, this was the man who had robbed him. Well, if counsel had done their job, the jury would have learned that, in fact, Paul Rowley confessed to the McCloskey robbery. The same is true for...
Well, there were more than one involved in the robbery. Who else was there?
Well, the state's theory was that Donald Cox and Kevin Edmonds and my client, Mr. Daniels, were there. That was the state's theory of the case. They proceeded on that theory, and probably for good reason. If they had proceeded on a theory that four people were there, then they would have had to admit to all this evidence pointing to Paul Rowley and away from Mr. Daniels. But the point is, under Strickland, you don't look back and determine whether, if you insert competent counsel for the defense, whether the state's theory might have been different. You've got to freeze that case in time as it stood, as the record stood, and insert competent counsel performing their job as they should have. And in this case, you have all this evidence that points to Paul Rowley. You've got physical evidence, all the physical evidence that points to Paul Rowley and away from Mr. Daniels. Counsel didn't use it, didn't know about it. One of the bigger pieces of evidence that I think counsel should have used was Marianne Beam. After she identified Mr. Daniels, she called the prosecution and she said, "I'm not so sure. And in fact, there's someone in the Group 2 lineup that looks an awful lot like this man." Well, Group 2 lineup, of course, involved Mr. Rowley. And I'd also like to talk for a moment about Kevin Edmonds, who the state court and the state suggest he ties this whole thing up. If you believe Mr. Edmonds, if the jury believed Mr. Edmonds, then there's no prejudice in this case. Well, in Rowley versus State, Paul Rowley versus State, and the Indiana Supreme Court overturned a decision against Mr. Rowley for the Geyser robberies that occurred 4 days before the robberies at issue in this case. And in that case, this Indiana Supreme Court said Kevin Edmonds was under a plea agreement for this and the related robberies and was unbelievable. He was incredible because of this, and so if that's what ties this whole thing together, then we've got to overturn Rowley's conviction. In this case, the Indiana Supreme Court says Edmonds, the same Edmonds, on the same set of facts, is the linchpin in this case. It just can't be both things. If the court doesn't have any other further questions,
was Edmonds in the Rowley? Was he also a co-defendant?
I don't know, Your Honor, whether he was a co-defendant, but he testified for the state.
Was he in on the robbery?
On the Geyser robbery?
One that Rowley was convicted of.
I believe that Rowley and Donald Cox were the only ones charged with the Geyser robbery.
Why did Edmonds testify? He wasn't there, was he?
I don't believe so, but I
don't know.
Have to check.
I'm asking you, was he? I'm just curious. If it's so definitive that he testified in one, therefore he's incredible in this one. If he didn't participate in the robbery or wasn't there, whatever reason he testified, maybe that's why he wasn't credible, because he wasn't there.
Kevin Edmonds' testimony in the Rowley case was that his buddies, Paul Rowley and Donald Cox, had informed him about the Geyser robbery.
Okay.
There are no further questions. I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
We'll hear now from Mr. Martin.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Respondent would urge this Court to affirm the District Court's decision denying habeas relief in this case because Mr. Daniels did not establish ineffective assistance of counsel. Initially and critical to a discussion of this entire appeal is the procedural default issue. And with respect to an argument that res judicata was applied to these claims, this is an argument that we typically hear from people who are not familiar with Indiana law. This is a routine practice in Indiana jurisprudence on post-conviction review. And the court typically, as it does here, uses the term res judicata and waiver. And there's a reason for this. To the extent that claims, discrete claims, allegations of deficient performance that are alleged to have prejudicially affected the defense have been litigated, those claims are barred by res judicata in the normal sense that courts interpret that term. However, to the extent that claims were known and available to be raised in a prior post-conviction action and weren't raised at that time, they are waived. Hence the term res judicata and waiver used jointly in that fashion.
Now, these weren't raised in the first post-conviction appeal, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. Now they did raise a claim of ineffective assistance with regard to trial counsel's failure to use a previous hypnosis of Mr. Street's son before he ultimately identified Mr. Daniels. So that claim is preserved for habeas review. However, none of the others are. These claims and the predicates for them were well known to Mr. Daniels and were not raised in his first post-conviction proceeding. And there's a reason for this. And that is because, and we see this often in post-conviction, when viable, colorable claims have been exhausted at previous levels of review, some of the theories that are offered in subsequent post-conviction actions can start to become somewhat attenuated from the facts, and I think that there is often a strategy employed that hopes to benefit from the remoteness in time and circumstance from the actual crimes and the trial on those crimes. And here, the linchpin, the theory that is chiefly offered here that they're claiming that trial counsel was ineffective for pursuing was pointing the finger at Paul Rowley. Now, to the extent that this claim would have any color at all, it could only have color with respect to whether it would have some kind of probability of salvaging Mr. Daniels from a sentence of death. In terms of gaining an acquittal on the actual offenses as charged, felony murder and the robberies, trying to point the finger at Paul Rowley would have no capacity to do that whatsoever. And in fact, and this is something that's been not really discussed, and I apologize for not raising this point in my brief, but taking a strategy of attacking or pointing the finger, rather, at Paul Rowley as to the exclusion of Mr. Daniels carried risks with it, and they're rather obvious. Counsel for the petitioner alluded to the appellate opinion from Rowley's conviction for the Geyser robberies. That opinion states in some of its factual discussion that Mr. Daniels was actually identified by the mother. This was a family in the Geyser case that was robbed. And the same individuals that were implicated in these crimes were similarly implicated in the Geyser robberies that occurred 4 days earlier that employed a similar, if not the same, modus operandi. And the mother of that family, who was an eyewitness, picked Daniels out of a lineup. Should counsel have...
For the earlier one, the Rowley case?
Yes, for the Geyser robbery.
The one that was referred to before, 4 days earlier.
Correct, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. To choose a strategy of pointing a finger at Rowley invites the possibility that we will have not just one accomplice witness for the state giving a version of events that completely inculpates Daniels, but two. Moreover, this would open the door to evidence of prior bad acts that would probably, under Indiana's evidentiary rules, have been otherwise inadmissible. And the record shows that trial counsel moved to suppress any potential testimony from Rowley after becoming aware of polygraph reports, which are inadmissible in Indiana. So it's clear trial counsel didn't want Rowley in front of this jury. So the whole notion of proceeding in this fashion, while it may have been a last-ditch way to save Daniels from a sentence of death, carried risks. Had they pursued this course, I submit to this court, we would be standing here today discussing an allegation of ineffective assistance for opening the door to prior bad acts evidence and inviting the testimony of another accomplice against Daniels by pursuing this course. certainly counsel had reasons for conducting the defense the way that they did. And when you look at the testimony of trial counsels from the post-conviction proceedings, they're rather vanilla, as that testimony tends to be, with a preponderance of "I don't recall" and "well, if you say the record reflects that, I guess that's right" in that kind of testimony, generally evidencing counsel's unfamiliarity some almost 20 years after the fact with the decisions that they made and why they made them. I would also just briefly like to point out to the court that the case here was very strong. We have four witnesses from each of the crimes, two identifying Daniels as a shooter, and all of them giving testimony that was consistent with the account that was given by Mr. Edmonds. The notion that shells that were found at Mr. Rowley's home match those that were found at the two shooting scenes somehow implicates Rowley, ignores the fact that this account is consistent with what Edmonds told the jury, which was that after the crimes, Mr. Cox gave the gun to Rowley after Daniels had given it back to him. I think that the Indiana Supreme Court addressed the fact that the testimony was intertwined and mutually corroborative.
Could I just intersect something here? But whose gun was it? Was it Cox's or Rowley's?
You know, Your Honor, I can't tell you who owned that gun.
Because Cox is the one that came up with it in the first place. And maybe he was just maybe giving it to Rowley to get rid of it?
That is, I think, what the evidence shows, Your Honor. But as far as, like, whose gun, who was the owner of the gun, I'm not sure if the record reflects that or not.
Rowley's the one that was found ultimately with the gun, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
But again, the circumstance of the shells at the crime scene, they were fired from the same gun, and the witnesses are giving similar accounts of what happened and identifying Daniels. And I think it's also important to note that none of the witnesses that they claim trial counsel should have more effectively impeached ever chose someone else to the exclusion of Daniels. For instance, yes, this is the man that committed these crimes, not this man. When they see Daniels, they identify Daniels. To the extent that there was any ambivalence or uncertainty prior to the ultimate identifications, it's nothing that is not typically seen with regard to pretrial identifications, and certainly nothing that would have convinced the jury that all four of these eyewitnesses were mistaken in their identification. Just a couple of things. The district court did not reject the procedural default argument. It noted that Indiana Supreme Court had found the claims waived by res judicata and waiver, but then went ahead and discussed the merits. And, of course, a court's treatment of the merits while concomitantly finding a waiver does not foreclose an adequate and independent state law ground barring habeas relief, and that's what we have here. And another thing.
But you still have the hypnosis issue. It's still viable. Is that right?
It is still viable. And I think that the discussion of the other claims shows that counsel's decision not to impeach Mr. Street in that fashion was not prejudicial. It's true that the Indiana Supreme Court, initially in the first post-conviction appeal, found that counsel had exercised a reasonable strategy there. To the extent that Daniel's counsel suggests that that was not the case and that they could have impeached him in some manner other than being confrontational with him on the witness stand because the strategy was not to vilify themselves in the eyes of the jury by coming after a 15-year-old young man that had just lost his father. May I finish responding to your question, Judge Manion?
Yeah,
But ultimately, I think that the court's finding that it was harmless addresses the prejudice prong of Strickland in this case, given the strength of the state's case. If the court has no further questions, I will just respectfully ask the court to affirm the district court's decision.
Thank you, Mr. Martin.
Thank you.
How much time does Ms. Bumholt have? You have 2 minutes, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, I'd like to address counsel has made an entirely new argument that was not present in their briefs, that perhaps all of these decisions were carried with them risks, and maybe, but that issue goes to the effectiveness of counsel. And even the Indiana Supreme Court recognized that counsel's conduct was not effective, that they did not have the information necessary to make those kinds of strategy decisions. And that is particularly true with respect to Tim Street. Counsel testified that they did not know whether Street had been hypnotized. I mean, at this point, they don't know anything to make a reasonable strategy decision. And to the extent that they can be thought to have had that information at their disposal, there's no reason why counsel would not use this information in some way. And they did not have to attack Tim Street or vilify themselves in the eyes of the jury. All they had to do was call Detective Vandegrift, who could testify that this man was hypnotized before he was able to identify anyone, that while under hypnosis he identified Franklin Welch, who subsequently was arrested based on that identification, and that later when he identified my client, he also every single time identified Paul Rowley. This isn't about pointing the finger at Paul Rowley. It's about creating reasonable doubt in the minds of the jurors. And the case that the jury should have heard, they didn't, because counsel didn't do their job. I'd also just very briefly like to address the res judicata argument that counsel made. The idea that Indiana courts routinely use confusing terms is certainly no reason not to follow Harris. If you use two terms at once, it's going to be confusing. The Indiana Supreme Court is free to say waiver and pull themselves within the ambit of Harris versus Reed, but they don't do that. Whether they do it on a regular basis or not is immaterial.
Counsel, your light has gone on now.
Okay, thank you. We just asked the court to reverse.
The court would like to thank Ms. Baumholt, who took this case by appointment of the court, for her efforts on behalf of her client. We would like to thank her law firm for having expended a significant amount of energy and resources with respect to the case as well. Indeed, our thanks to both counsel in the case, and the case will be taken under advisement.